Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Coming up on the free-for-all, we're blowing this thing up. We're doing it completely different. Joanna Stern is here. The Revolution, coming up.
This is Free-for-All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
Hey, so we're going to do something a little different today. This is going to be either the beginning of a beautiful partnership or, you know,
the end.
Go down in flames. But so if you've been following this podcast over the past year, and I appreciate it if you have, you know, it's me babbling on with a bunch of guests. But for a long time, I've wanted to work with somebody who's been a guest on this show, but sort of share the reins of hosting and do something a little different. And so joining me as my co-host is the illustrious Wall Street Journal tech columnist, Joanna Stern. Joanna.
I'm so nervous.
You're nervous? You're never nervous. You're the least nervous person I know.
I'm so nervous.
You do everyone's podcast.
I know.
You're a multimedia star. You have
Can you say whore on the show?
Star.
Can we get a bleep?
You know, there is not a medium you aren't comfortable with, Joanna, so you are going to survive swimmingly on this. But let me just explain, and please interject here, Joanna. The idea of this new podcast, this historic podcast, is that you and I have our little columnist fiefdoms at the Wall Street Journal. Myself, I cover sports like snooker and, you know, darts. And Joanna, you cover, technology?
It's a little thing called technology.
And so
personal technology.
But believe it or not, you and I are capable of reading other parts of the paper, and we're fascinated oftentimes by things that are happening elsewhere in the Wall Street Journal. And so sort of the conceit of this is that we bring on guests from the paper each and every week to talk about things that fascinate us elsewhere in the Wall Street Journal or even beyond in the great wide world. And so the thing, Joanna, that I wanted to talk about, and I've wanted to talk about this for weeks now, but the fascination, the obsession, the controversy over fake news.
Which is basically anything that isn't sports or technology.
Anything that is not about an iPod or a Giants game is fake, people. We're letting you know now. But this has, you know, ever since the election, and probably for, you know, some time before the election, there has been this roiling about fake news and whether or not this tipped the balances in the election or, you know, what does it mean for legitimate news organizations such as the illustrious Wall Street Journal? And what does it mean for, more importantly, our social media carriers like Facebook, Twitter, and beyond. And I wanted to bring on a guest, and I thought of no better person than our boss, Jerry Baker.
Mark Zuckerberg.
Our Mark Zuckerberg. But Mr. Baker, thank you for joining us on this historic voyage of the Jason and Joanna podcast.
We're open to names, by the way.
You're open to names
for the podcast. Yeah.
Okay. Fake news obviously is not going to be a good place to start.
It's not a bad one. It's not a bad name.
Make news. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you both. Two of my favorite people.
Oh, I appreciate that. Aww. I know you're telling the truth, at least with Joanna.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, is this a legit concern, fake news, or is this something that's just been whipped up into this feverish hype in the week since the election?
Actually, before we do that, which is a great question, I think we need to just establish for some people, because I really did not know what is fake news. It sounds like something that's like, oh, fake news, news that isn't real, right? Like that would be the definition. But what is
it?
Right.
So, I mean, that's a very, very pertinent observation and question, Joanna, because I was actually going to say that one of the things I'm going to answer your question, Jason, by saying, essentially, I think it is trumped up, shall we say, if you'll forgive the phrase. I think it's a lot of exaggeration, panic, and hysteria. Mm-hmm. But to answer Joanna's question in the same answer, you see, the issue is fake news has been around forever, right? Okay, I mean, the first, since man and indeed woman first started scratching on tablets, you know, millions of years ago.
iPads?
They've, exactly, yeah, millions. Was it really that long? Funny, it only seems like 2010. Is it really? It's amazing how time flies. But anyway, they, you know, the since they've been doing that on things even before what we now call tablets, they've been making stuff up, right? People have been telling tall tales. You know, sometimes for entertainment, sometimes deliberately to deceive people. Okay, so that's been going on for a very, very, very long time. But what we're talking about, obviously, as you say, Joanna, now, is that what people are particularly agitated and exercised about is what we saw particularly in the course of the election campaign, where websites which are not authorized or not authorities on the news, not respected voices and brands for the provision of news, would pop up with stories saying Hillary Clinton is a child molester, or you know, Donald Trump personally wrestled a
endorsed bear by the Pope, I think the, was a big
yeah one. Endorsed by the Pope, or you know, killed three evil terrorists with his bare hands and ripped them limb from limb. You know, they would show up, and the reason, look, this stuff is obviously, you know, patently nonsense, but it would show up in news, in people's social media feeds. Okay, yeah. It would sort of crop up on Facebook in particular, which seems to be particularly, I suppose, easy to get this stuff onto, and Twitter and elsewhere too. And so there has been this concern that, oh my goodness, when someone sees a story from XYZ news source which says Hillary Clinton is a child molester, the average Facebook reader, user, sees that, and then, on, you know, also cropping up his feed in, is the Wall Street Journal saying the Dow Jones hit 19,375. And the idea is that they're not able to distinguish between the Wall Street Journal's real news and completely made-up news. I have a lot of difficulty believing this is a huge problem. One, because, as I say, first of all, people have been making up stuff for a very long time. And people are prepared to believe things which suit them, right?
Yeah. Sure.
One of my, you know, there's some favorite statistics. Take the, you know, there, to this day, 35%, I think, of Americans, no, there's a little bit less than that, maybe 20% of Americans believe that Barack Obama is a Muslim. Back in 2004, I remember very well the election campaign of 2004 when John Kerry lost narrowly to George W. Bush. 37% of Americans, I think, in the final polls that were taken, thought that Saddam Hussein had been behind the 9/11 attacks. Yeah. I give those two examples because they, and how do they come to believe those things? They came to believe those things because people propagated those theories. But more importantly, much, much more importantly, they believe those things because they wanted to believe them. So when you had this fake news of the Pope endorsing Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton being at the center of a child sex ring, that was one of the stories, including this awful story, this pizza parlor in Washington, D.C., which was supposedly the hub of this child sex ring. But the idea that there are people out there with completely open minds going through their Facebook feed thinking, oh, there's the Wall Street Journal telling me that the New York Giants won yet again this weekend, and there's that very funny Jason Gay telling me how they did it, and there's Joanna Stern telling me what latest device I should use, and oh yes, and my goodness, Hillary Clinton's a child molester. I didn't know that. Me, I can't possibly vote for that person. That's not how it works. This news stuff gets around because there are people out there who so despise Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, for that matter, or anybody else, that they have already made up their minds. And this information is put out there just to reinforce their views. I mean, we live in this highly partisan world where people basically choose their own news sources.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, not everybody, but a lot of people. So they're prepared to believe stuff. So this idea that there were people who were sort of at the last minute kind of suddenly persuaded by these outrageously false stories not to vote for Hillary Clinton, I think is profoundly, profoundly absurd.
Is someone in your capacity, though, who is overseeing a news organization, would you like, all things being equal, for a social media outfit like Facebook to make a differentiation and maybe prioritize, you know, quote-unquote legitimate news sources? It's a strange thing because we are not in a licensed profession. You know, we are not like doctors and lawyers who have an actual, you know, degree that we get for, you know, becoming this. It's sort of, we're all winging it in a way.
Can we all get press passes?
Yeah. But would you like to see some, I mean, you know, like Facebook, regardless of whether or not this is an actual, you know, crisis, they have agreed to address it and mend their ways. And what would you like to see, if anything?
Not what Facebook are doing. I mean, look, I think the problem, here's the problem, which is, you know, what's the great Latin phrase? Who's guarding the guardians? Quis custodiat ipsos custodes? Those of you who studied Latin. You know, who's making the decisions that's protecting us, right? So who's making the decisions that this news can be trusted and this news can't be trusted? Well, Facebook have given us an answer, which is, you know, a panel of sort of six high priests and priestesses of the news profession, right. Which, who, by the way, all tend to, surprise, surprise, lean in one particular political direction. I think that's going to just make things worse, actually, because immediately that came out and we saw that it's going to be these six organizations, again, not all of them, but most of them, you know, in the view of, most of them have a credibility problem in the view of a lot of people because they are seen as being politically biased. If Facebook honestly think that that is going to make anybody believe one story on Facebook against another, I think they're crazy, because I think it'll just reinforce the lack of trust that's out there in the first place. Look, the other thing, and again, I have to say this, where this whole fake news frenzy kind of came from in the last few years, is I do think the problem is that the main I don't want to use the mainstream media term because it's such a terrible cliche, but the traditional media have unfortunately for too long not been trusted. You know, I mean, they've been...
I prefer dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs, mm-hmm. That's a good one. Yeah, I never heard that one before. Mm-hmm. I'm
a Tyrannosaurus Rex.
You mean in the day before the iPad dinosaurs. You know, they have not been trusted for a long time because people have perceived them to be politically biased. You know, in the view of certain, I won't name names, but in so many of the kind of traditional media, there is this phantom glory day of, you know, glory days of 30, 40, 50 years ago, when what you read in the New York Times or you saw on the CBS Evening News was God's truth delivered directly to you by, you know, the Sulzbergers or Dan Rather. And there was, you know, you just believed, you had to believe it because it was true. And it wasn't ever. They're going to knock these organizations. They're good news organizations that do their best, I think, most of the time to produce good news. But it's not the whole truth. It's not the whole objective, unvarnished truth. And it never was. And people started to see that and to say, you know what, actually, I don't really trust what Dan Rather's telling me on, you know, on the CBS Evening News or what the New York Times is necessarily putting on its front page. That's where where this proliferation of alternative sources of news came from, because they felt that not only did they not trust the news they'd been used to getting, but they didn't accept at all the idea that this was the unvarnished, absolutely unfiltered, objective truth.
Yeah.
And so that's what's given rise to these alternative sources of news, and ultimately to something like fake news. So going back to your point, I don't think Facebook, by reasserting the authority of so many of these traditional news organizations and saying, hey, this is right, this is wrong, I don't think it's going to solve the problem at all. It's just going to take us back to where we were.
Joanna, do you think that among the youngins, in the tech world in particular, that there is, you know, we've heard a lot about news agnosticism, that people aren't, you know, loyal to news brands and so on, and that they're not subscribing to newspapers, certainly not print newspapers, that they are more susceptible to this kind of thing? There was this really great piece Sue Schellenberger wrote for the Journal a couple of weeks ago where there was a study of young people where they weren't able really to differentiate between fake and real news.
I mean, I was actually going to say that I feel like part of this, as Jerry's been saying, has been a problem for, you know, it's been a problem as all this time. But even if you think about some of our pages, right, it's sometimes hard even on our site to know the difference between a news story and an editorial or a column, right? And we sort of assume that through the tone of that story or the presentation slightly that the reader's going to understand that this is someone's opinion versus this is a news story.
Do they need that hand-holding, though?
I think many people are dumb. You know, I mean... I hope that we have a higher caliber of readers and listeners.
Sure.
And
no
viewers.
Wall Street Journal
no,
readers.
No, no, but... Yeah. But when you have all of this sort of content now in your feed, right, it's hard to tell the difference between them. And I think it goes back to that social sort of aspect of how news sort of people want to believe what they want to believe, but they also want to believe what their friend told them, right? They're sort of like, oh, I heard that, you know,
sure,
this will cause chicken pox. You know, this new sort of laundry detergent will cause chicken pox. We shouldn't use that, right? And so that sort of spirals. And the problem with the social media situation is that, and I spoke to Facebook about this last week when they announced their reporting. They have the new reporting structure of, like, you know, you can hit that something is possibly fake news on when, I mean, they're rolling that out. It's because things get circulated from your friends and you don't know what news source this is ultimately coming from. Right. You've just seen that somebody shared this and this is in your feed.
I mean, I'm just waiting for the day where I write, you know, Alabama's the number one team in the country and someone tags it as fake and it somehow slides off the algorithm or something like that. Jerry, is there
Didn't
such
write
a thing?
That?
I mean,
is there about Michigan and something?
That's
and
right.
Everyone said that was fake. Michigan,
as we know, Jason, Notre Dame are the number one team in the
that's
country.
That's true.
So there's no danger of anybody
talk
declaring
about, talk
that
about
to be
some
fake.
Fake news. But, you know, there is this belief within news organizations, and I don't know if you're one of them, Jerry, that, like, this might create some wind at the backs of traditional news organizations because people realize that, you know, they cannot subsist completely on the algorithm of their social media network. And is the Trump bump, so to speak, a real thing?
It is. I mean, we've seen at the Wall Street Journal a really significant increase in subscriptions, actually during the campaign itself, and since the campaign. We haven't published the official numbers, but our circulation has been growing for the journal. Our digital circulation has been growing for the last 2 years steadily. It's accelerated quite dramatically in the last 3 months, and again, particularly since the election. And other traditional news organizations have reported similar increases. So definitely, I think that's partly a reflection. Just there's more interest in the news. People want to know what to make sense. There's an extraordinary election we've just had.
Is it because
sense
of
it?
Piece my dog wrote last week?
That piece actually did get quite a lot of subscribers. Actually, I have to say, possibly
you, I
may
can't
account,
tell if you're you, joking.
Possibly,
but
no, I'm not. Possibly may account for all of the additional subscribers that we've had.
You
it
know
may
this
not
piece of
be
information.
Donald Trump, the election.
I just want it for the viewers,
news,
for the listeners. My dog wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal last week. He had a byline and he had a head cut. And I'm surprised I didn't quit the day after because I feel
Bowser.
Bowser. And yes, now the editor-in-chief of the paper knows my dog's name because he's a columnist.
Yeah.
You know, probably most likely the proudest day of my career.
It's a lot less expensive than
this, the succession
and also, by the way, it's a lot less trouble, too. Doesn't complain at all when we cut his copy or do anything to his copy or mess around with the video or anything like that. It's fantastic.
On the subscription thing, though, just, you know, when I mention this to people, readers, they're always fascinated by this, but you know quite literally what kind of subscription, if people are ordering subscriptions off a particular story. We've had a number of really terrific, longer investigative type stories in recent months that we've been running that I've heard just through the grapevine have, you know, dozens, if not more, subscriptions. Just and you can see that piece of data.
I mean, in real time, you know,
we're
literally
talk about
minute
technology
by minute,
after,
in real time, as they say, I can see which stories are generating, are turning people from just sort of, you know, people who come in to look at a story and then decide they want to read on, and to read on they have to subscribe.
Yeah.
So they click to subscribe, and we track that. I mean, we don't track the individuals, but we track the aggregate numbers, and we know the total numbers for each story. And I'm joking aside, Browser's journalistic debut
did actually produce
a significant uplift in subscriptions. I'm glad to say, much as I loved it, it didn't produce as many additional subscriptions as our terrific coverage of what's happened to the stock market in the last month, or our great investigative coverage of a company like Theranos or something like that. But I have to say, it did produce a significant number of subscriptions. By the way, of course, as I should say, in the interest of full disclosure and fairness, as do the columns of one Jason Gay.
All right. Yeah.
So we are enormously grateful to both of you.
Have you considered replacing me with a dog?
It depends what you do. If the Patriots win the Super Bowl again, Jason, yes.
It needs to be a herding group dog. That's all I ask if you replace me with a dog.
I think you're like a lab.
I'm a lab?
You're like a lab.
I'm loyal and a little pudgy?
No, they're adorable and smart and
Joanna's dog has the brilliantly punning name Browser. What are we going to call Jason's dog?
We're going to take a quick pause for a second. We'll be back in a few hours with Jerry Baker.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
I'm Veronica Dagger. Do you want to know how the rich invest, spend, and protect their money? Then listen to the Watching Your Wealth podcast. For more information, check us out at WSJ.com/podcasts and find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and now Spotify.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. We are still here talking fake news with Jerry Baker and Jason Gay. I'm Joanna Stern.
While we have you here, let's talk a tiny bit more about the events of the last 6 weeks.
And
we have a president of the United States who's literally up the street. He's one block over and seven blocks up or eight blocks up. And one thing that I find very funny about the coverage of Trump, which is, you know, for obvious reasons, very serious and there's very significant global impact and so on. But there, no one's really talking about the New York aspect of this, that we have this president-elect who is living in a building up the street and what it does to the dynamic of New York City. You went by like the day after the election, I believe, didn't you?
I did. I went to see him 2 days after the election. Yeah, we went and did an interview with him. Yeah,
And you can't just walk in there now, can you?
Funny enough, you can get into Trump Tower. I'll tell you, it's strange. I've had visitors. It's the holiday season, and I've had my family have been visiting me from England. Two separate sets of parts of my family have visited from England and staying with me, and the Trump thing has become part of the New York tour. The New York tour now.
Like, even go look at the building.
They go and look at the building, and you can actually. I was actually surprised. They said you can walk in. There's a security gate there, but members of the public, because there's shops and there's restaurants and there's the Starbucks and there's the Trump grill.
There's like
with
the press holding area.
Steaks.
There's like a press
right
when you
walk
the
elevator,
in. It's like
right?
Right opposite the elevators, right as you walk in. But there are shops and restaurants in there so people can go. So even though the police and the Secret Service have blocked off the street outside and indeed the block around Trump Tower, they've set up a security checkpoint. You go through metal detectors, but you can get in. You can actually get into the I'm not sure if I should be broadcasting.
Yeah, I know.
No, I can't believe it. Sorry, I just made all that up. That was a piece of fake news, people. It's not true. You can't go anywhere near Trump Tower.
I'm going to report that. I'm going to get Pointer or ABC News to confirm that. But mostly
Facebook
just
are going to stamp that.
Yeah.
No, it's true. It's true. You can as of now. As of last week, I actually don't know. Maybe they're tightening security as we get closer to the big day. But you could as of last week. Go in and buy a Starbucks at that first floor, second floor Starbucks.
It's truly terrible, though, for Midtown traffic.
It is.
I mean, absolutely horrific. Yeah. I can understand, some reasons he'd like to be in New York, but just he knows how bad Midtown traffic is. He's got to know.
Well, and the worry is that there's still a strong possibility that apparently he will come. He's talking about coming back every weekend.
It's not okay.
And can you imagine? So that will be coming back from Kennedy Airport every weekend. You know what that will be like? The presidential motorcade.
He's not going to take the Acela.
Maybe we should suggest it. Or maybe there's a royal train.
Tell him about city bikes.
Right. That's right. It could be like a special motorcade.
But he's not the first president to make noise about wanting to have a base in his hometown. I think Michelle Obama, there was some talk about whether or not she would remain in Chicago when Barack Obama was first elected.
That's
but
true.
Do you
but
think
she
that just
but she didn't remember.
No, she didn't. Yeah, yeah. But just the tradition eventually and the logistics of it just becomes overwhelming and he's going to be in D.C.
Would think so. I think it's just but he's does his own thing. I mean he is the one thing one of the many things we can say about Donald Trump is he does things differently from everybody else ever seen in this kind of a position.
When you went to see him, what was it, 36 hours after he won, it's become pretty clear in the way that he's retold the story and some of the interviews he's given that he was as surprised as a lot of people that he won.
Yeah, he was. He said it. I think he said at one of those rallies last week that he, kind of was preparing
for
his concession speech and fully expecting Hillary to win. I saw him actually, it was the day, 2 days after the election. He'd just gone to see the president in the White House, President Obama. And he came away, and it was very striking, very clearly very impressed. It was the first time they'd ever met. And remember, during the campaign, at one point he said he was the worst president in history.
Founded ISIS.
Founded ISIS, that's right. He clearly changed his mind. I think the thing about Trump, I've met him several times during the campaign and then spoken, did that and spoken to him a couple of times since the election. He's a pragmatist, right? He's not remotely ideological. I don't really genuinely think he has a profoundly ideological belief at all, which is kind of both good and worrying, right? It's good in the sense that he'll probably do what he thinks will be good. Some people will find that worrying that they'll do what he thinks will be good. But I don't think he will, unlike, you know, every other political figure who proceeds on the basis of some philosophical, political, ideological premises, I don't think this new next president will be like that at all. I think he will, and I think you're already seeing that in his appointments. You know, he's appointed a lot of conservatives, but he's also appointed people who are not traditional conservatives. And I think you're going to see, you know, that he's going to just he's going to try and get things done in a way that he thinks just is necessitated by the challenges the country faces. And again, I think that's both encouraging and in some ways concerning.
A lot of rich guys on that cabinet. Joanna.
And guys.
What do you what do you think of the tech summit?
I fell into the trap of looking at all the faces of the CEOs. Those memes were pretty good.
The hostage video.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I wish we knew. I mean, I've obviously read the reports about what was discussed, and we'll see. But I think it'll be interesting to see how Silicon Valley and some of these leaders decide they want to work with him. I guess there was a leaked memo today from Tim Cook saying that, you know, that he was getting some pressure or some criticism within Apple about why he went to the meeting. And he very clearly said it was an olive branch. He wants to have a conversation.
Can you say no to that?
I heard
from a very, very good source afterwards that the meeting went very well in terms of it. You know, given that these are all people who had, almost to a man and woman, opposed Trump directly, indirectly. I mean, there were Safra Catz, actually, I think, had been a supporter. And, of course, Peter Thiel was there. But the rest, you know, Sheryl Sandberg, Tim Cook, the Google crowd had been fierce opponents, so it wasn't necessarily expected to be a meeting of minds. But I'm told by people very close that it was actually there was a lot of agreement. And one of the things that Trump listened very carefully to was the tech people saying they really need help on the visa front, the H-1B visa, which they're one of the big issues, which is you know, they're losing smart people because because of visa restrictions. And Trump listened to that very carefully and was apparently quite sympathetic to it. So, you know, which, given his stance on immigration, is interesting. Right. I think he also had a very positive one-on-one separate meeting with Tim Cook straight afterwards, which both sides, I think, seem to think went well. So that's, to me,
that
a perfect example.
He also discussed with Sandberg about maternity leave.
Yes,
some
that's
of the things
right.
Some
of the things
she wanted,
because Ivanka is very keen on that. She's worked on a lot of that. Yeah. So, but that's just, again, an
example. By the way, I have to say, I don't know how much we're sharing, but I know there's not been any formal announcement about what's going to happen with the First Lady, but I'm all for that shakeup. I think that's going to be very interesting to see.
Well, that Ivanka becomes the First Lady rather than Melania.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's, you know, the talk of her really taking
a bigger
role.
Oh, I think she will. And her husband, Jared Kushner, who's very influential, who's probably the single most influential person, I think, political terms, in Trump's ear. So I think that's right. And they have, by the way, and talking of sort of ideology, they're very politically very different. They are not. I mean, you've got this really interesting phenomenon of basically Republicans, a lot of conservative Republicans, Mike Pence, vice president.
Right.
You know, Republican leadership in Congress, which is very conservative, Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell. And I think they're all thinking, whoa, great, this is exciting. And they've got some of their people, you know, into key positions. You know, Pruitt at the EPA, Price at Health, who's going to dismantle Obamacare. And I think a lot of those people are thinking, whoa, this is great. We've got a sort of a conservative restoration. But actually, you look harder and you look at the role that Ivanka and Jared, and you look at someone like Steve Bannon, who's going to be very, you know, the former Breitbart who's going to be very influential. It's not as simple as that. It's not. No. This is not a conservative. This is not a solidly conservative, traditionally conservative leaning administration. It's going to be much more complex.
When are we going to get our fancy sit down with Trump like the New York Times had?
We're working on it.
Yeah,
we're working on it.
Can we go to that meeting? We'll just stand in the back and we won't eat anything, I promise.
That's all right. Thank you.
What do you mean?
You know, the Times, you know, you had the big fanfare meeting
turned it off.
Did they have food there?
Yeah.
You know, there was untouched cold cuts, I believe, in the middle of the table.
We can at least offer some nicer food.
We'll try. I mean, you know, we can work on that. Absolutely. Maybe some Trump steaks.
Yeah.
Trump steaks. He doesn't drink, so no good offering the usual lunchtime booze.
Is there
thing that we do here? But
is there anything truth from, you know? And I know you've had a number of opportunities to talk to him, but one of the things that gets said a lot is that he is quite influenced by the last person that he has an engagement with. And so when you mentioned the tech summit and like people saying it went positively, there's this belief like, okay, well, sure, in the moment in the room when people are saying things, he's responding to them positively, and that then maybe, you know, minds change and so on and so forth. Is that a more acute – I mean, all of us are kind of that way in a way. But is that a very acute and palpable feeling with him?
Yes. I mean, I think on some of these issues where he hasn't necessarily been very engaged in his career, and this is not a criticism, it's just, you know, someone who's built a business, he hasn't probably spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, the politics, the policy of – politics of healthcare or education or foreign policy or some of these issues. And so when he meets people who have spent their entire lives and have very strong and very well-informed opinions on these topics and who talk to him and explain the way they see the world to him, it probably does leave an impression. I don't think he does have many preconceived ideas on some of these issues, and again, I don't say that necessarily in a negative way. I think it's it can be a positive thing that he's listening, that he's willing to listen to people. So I think, I think he does have that. I think that's that is a strength. I mean, again, what you don't want is someone, you know, who listens to one person who tells him to do one thing, and then 15 minutes later listens to somebody else who tells him to do the other thing, and then then it is the question of the last person who got to him. I don't think he's like that. To be fair, that would be a little. Disturbing, if you like. I'm sure he's not like that, but I think he does on some of these issues where he hasn't necessarily had the kind of, you know, empirical absorption that some people, that other politicians have. I think he does listen.
Are we staffing up? And I keep reading about news organizations feeling like there's a real moment now to, like, you know, I mean, not that we didn't have a Washington bureau before, but to beef up in Washington, that there's intense reader interest in this administration.
I know you tech and sports people think that we don't have any other coverage in the paper, but I'm here to tell you.
To feel
I'm here
that
to tell you actually that there's.
Where would we read that?
Some financial coverage. There is.
Where would
I mean?
We,
is there any part?
Well,
of,
you
no.
could do www.wsj.com or open it up on your open the app up on your mobile phone. You might. I'll give you some tech guidance if you like. I'll take you through.
It says fake news. In my Facebook feed.
I'll take you through some of our mobile devices and show you how to get the best out of them.
Let me scratch my last question. It wasn't very good. Let me ask you this instead. Do you think there's any possibility that they scrap those briefings, those press briefings, or at least sort of rearrange the arrangement that they've had for a long time with the White House Correspondents Association, saying who can sit where and so on, and shake that up a little bit? No?
I mean, look, again, he's the president. He can kind of do what he likes. But I think the reason that that operates like that is because it works for both sides, right? I mean, I worked in Washington. I covered the White House for quite a few years, actually.
Is it exciting or boring?
When there's a big story, it's incredibly exciting. There's nothing more exciting. I mean, there are days when you're sitting there and there's nothing happening, and then you can catch up on your fantasy football or whatever. But it is most of the time. It's exciting. It's the presidency of the United States is the most powerful place in the world. But I think it works for both sides, and I don't see why on earth Trump wouldn't want to have a press corps that was very engaged and constantly being updated and, you know, given information and constantly interacting. It would not serve him.
See, I think they're just going to have one of those iPad robots on the stage with the Twitter feed, then they're going to do it. They're they might just pump in some of the tweets.
Yep. You should be out there suggesting that. That's a good idea.
I think I have a future there.
For all the sort of talk about how he has detonated the traditional media by, you know, going direct to source with the Twitter and so on, there is and how much he has battled with legacy media. Nobody is a bigger media consumer, I believe, in the history of this country than Trump. Trump has such a vaunted opinion of what Person of the Year for Time magazine is, or what a feature, you know, what an 8 o'clock segment on CNN is, or what the front page of the Wall Street Journal is. I mean, those things mean a great deal to him. And in many ways, he's an anachronism because he really, really, really cares. He's the ultimate consumer.
Absolutely. I mean, no question. Look, I speaking very personally, I've been a journalist for, more than 30 years. And, you know, one of the privileges of our job is you get to talk to important people and people who have interesting and important things to say. And I've covered politics on and off, you know, in various different guises for more than 20 years. And I have heard directly from Donald Trump more in the last in the year that I first we first really got to know each other than I've heard from any other politician directly in my life. I mean, there's no other politician in this country. I've been in this country for 20 years or in Britain for 10, 15 years previous to that, and Japan for some time. There's no other politician who will, and it's not just the editor of the Wall Street Journal, you know, he'll read a piece written by, you know, a reporter for the New York Times or whatever, or he'll see something on TV and see them talking, and he'll email them or call them or text them. He is, and again, he's very, very, you're absolutely right. He spends a large amount of time reading, watching, absorbing the media, and then interacting with them. He is, you know, and that one of the reasons for his success, by the way. I mean, you know, I think it's no accident that he emerged from nowhere in the Republican field by doing while he was doing that, because it was the fact that he was doing that that got him, you know, that got him attention in the media.
His favorite columnist is probably my dog, though.
You have to get him on.
I have one last question for you. I know you have a newspaper to run, but one thing that I've wanted to ask for a while is that I'm always struck in this, and Joanne and I have talked about this, that in this day and age when there's so much focus on digital product, and it is a huge part of our job description here is to think digitally and not think, you know, in old traditional newspaper terms always. But I'm always struck by the number of people who, when you're writing about somebody, will ask at the end of the interview, is this going to be in print as well?
Yeah.
And the validation.
Do you get that, Joanna?
The validation of print. And it still is strong. And why do you believe that is?
I think firstly, it's possibly a generational thing. I mean, I don't know what, you know, I can't speak for you. Most people who say that to me are, frankly, my generation or if that's even possible, even older. I think about my kids' generation. I'm not sure. I'd be interested to know. You're closer to it than I am. I don't think that's as widespread among younger people. Secondly, I mean, but I would say there is another possible explanation, which I'd like to believe, and I think, which is that there is still something, and you hint at it, Jason, in your question. There is still something kind of validating about and real about seeing something in print. You know, it's there physically. You know, it disappears, obviously. Pretty good. Actually, it disappears more effectively than anything that you ever do digitally.
For Snapchat.
Except for Snapchat. Oh, true. Correct. Very good, yeah. But it's
print is the new Snapchat.
Exactly. But it's, you know, it's, there is something about, I think it's not just about the physical product. Yeah. It's also, and I think this is important, a print is by its physical very nature limited, right? It's constrained. Yeah. We have 35, 40 pages of the Wall Street Journal every day, which means we, the editors, have got to make the decisions about what goes into that. Digitally, I mean, obviously we still edit stories, but there's literally no limit, right, to what goes in. So I think there's still a sense that when with
Did
a
I
newspaper...
Just hear my next column could be 5,000 words long?
With a newspaper... I thought it was, actually. I thought,
wait,
all columns,
you write
I thought
a column too?
They seem 5,000 words long, Joe. Oh, no, sorry.
Oh, God. But
you know, I think there is a sense that people have actually taken the trouble to choose a limited number of stories, and they must have chosen those stories because they're the most important things that happen. It's called curation. Yeah. It's called editing. There is still a sense in which that, and this is what I still think, why I still think a printed paper has validity. That is that's the choice that we've made of the most important, or whatever it is, you know, combination of most important, most readable, most enjoyable, you know, most relevant stories to our readership every day. And, by the way, you know, so if you take the total output of the Wall Street Journal, probably less than a fifth of it appears in print, right? Something like that in terms of the total number of stories.
Wow.
So there is still something, therefore, about the decision to put something in print that gives it a particular cogency and a particular authority. By the way, I'm struck by this with newsletters too. I mean, I do a morning newsletter. Yeah. I'm sorry to plug my morning newsletter called The 10 Point.
Everyone should subscribe.
Has over 200,000 subscribers.
Yeah,
that is a more. That's it. And the reason.
What time
I think,
do you have to get up to work on that thing? 2
I get up at 6.
Oh, yeah. 6.
Six-ish. I get up at 6, and I have a brilliant reporter who drafts it for me, and then I kind of rewrite it. But I raise that only because it's the same kind of phenomenon as a printed newspaper, which is that people, this is what we've chosen to tell you, not because we're we know more than you, but just because it's, you know, this is what we do. We spend all our day considering these important stories, and these are the things that we think are the things you really need to know this morning. I think that's where I think, by the way, for all the hand-wringing about journalism, that's why I think real quality journalism, above all, has a future, because there's so much information out there. People still want to know. You tell us, we can obviously find other stuff if we want to too, and that's the beauty of the democracy of the digital age. But you tell us what you think are the most important stories today, and, you know, make it a bit easier for us, and we'll go on and do the stuff that actually really matters to us.
Yeah, and even if you're not a subscriber, you can get the 10-point.
Thank you. You can.
So if you're listening, do that, because it's a great way to see the headlines. That's basically the only way I read the Wall Street Journal. I probably shouldn't tell anyone that.
We should also mention it makes a perfect holiday gift for loved ones.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right.
You can wrap up your present. No, you can't do that.
Wall Street digital print subscription.
Yeah, it's great wrapping paper.
Yeah.
Talking of wrapping, I am going to have to run.
Yes.
But I do want to say, first of all, thank you very much. This is a great, great completely new product.
This is a new partnership. We're going to see how it goes.
Fantastic. It's great.
We're
going to
see
I mean, and I meant what I said. I don't say this to everybody, so forgive me. Please don't tell anyone this.
Yeah.
I know no one will be listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
but you really are, you two are the finest of your, of the genre of, commentator, journalist. There's nobody better anywhere. You're brilliant and a key part of the Wall Street Journal, a key part of the appeal of the Wall Street Journal, and I'm enormously grateful to you both. And
one more high five over here.
Happy holidays, compliments of the season, happy new year. Keep
you
doing
too.
It all in 2017.
And when you say you two, you mean me and Browser the dog, right? Jerry Baker,
star of 2016.
Is the editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal and
thank
the first guest.
I know, first guest.
On this new format show.
Particularly honored.
Which thank you so much. We actually recorded this and might put
up.
It out to the world.
Good.
It might not be picked up. Is this going to be picked up for another season?
Yeah, maybe.
Nobody listens.
Heard we were not picked up for another season.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously.